everyone, and welcome to episode 23 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Normally, the podcast is built in an interview style in which I get to speak to some really awesome specialists about really specific stuff. This week, I'm doing things a bit differently, zooming out to look at some of the biggest, most persistent myths about the Middle Ages, the ones that drive historians up the wall. Sometimes I visit libraries and I call a version of this talk filthy and flat because we tend to be taught that this is the way the medieval world was. And it's a shame, really, because before I went to school, I thought the Middle Ages was great and that people were like us, but with more awesome outfits. And I learned in school that people back in the day were filthy and ignorant, and I was disappointed. So when I took a medieval romance course in university with the amazing Joanne Finden, I relit the love that I had for this time period. So I started out writing as the 5-Minute Medievalist on the internet because I couldn't believe the information that were routinely given. Misinformation, I should say. So we're going to take things apart today, shall we? And if we come across something that you didn't know before, no shame. We've all been taught weird things about the Middle Ages. So I went on Twitter and Facebook to ask people what they thought most ground their gears about the Middle Ages, what misconceptions people had that were really annoying about the Middle Ages. And we're going to start with one that a whole bunch of people came up with, which was the Dark Ages. So there's a time period between about 500 and 1000, or 1066, if you want to get pretty specific, that people call the Dark Ages. And this is really based on kind of a narrow point of view where you think of the Dark Ages as a time when the Roman Empire fell. And it's true that around the early 400s, the Roman Empire started to recede, as empires do. It started to collapse on itself, and it started to recede from most parts of Europe. And at the same time, there were all sorts of invasions coming from the East. So in a way, this is a dark period if you're a Roman. But if you're not a Roman, if you're one of the people that the Romans have enslaved, or if you're some of the people who are coming from the East, this is not necessarily a dark time. And if we're going to call it the Dark Ages, we're also forgetting the people that were moving on with life, even in traditional Roman ways, further to the East in Byzantium, where a lot of the Roman traditions were continuing. So this is only a Dark Ages if you think of it as you are a Roman citizen and all of a sudden you've lost your property and maybe, you know, some of the things that are important to you. But for everybody else, this is not necessarily a Dark Ages. At this time, society was restructured, so it wasn't a decentralized Roman government in most of Europe, and politics was restructured at the same time. But this didn't mean that everything collapsed and people forgot how to do the basic things in life, like they forgot how to read, or they forgot how to cast metal, or they forgot how to make beautiful things. People were still creating art and music, and they were still having fun, and they were still doing all sorts of the things they were doing before, you know, someone came up with this idea of being the Dark Ages. In a sense, it is a Dark Ages for historians in that many of the records from that time have been lost. Many of the records that we think of as being kind of routine in terms of Roman administration don't exist anymore because the Roman Empire doesn't have the same influence or spread as it did at that time. So it's kind of a Dark Ages for historians in that there's a period in which it's hard to find sources. But this doesn't mean that it's a time in which life was absolutely terrible for everyone and they all kind of went back to the Stone Age in their thinking or in what they were doing. And I think that anybody that looks at art from what's the so-called Dark Ages, you can see how beautiful things were and how intricately made they were and how culture went on and culture evolved and changed, but it didn't disappear. And so the Dark Ages is myth. There were no Dark Ages. It was just a different time for different people. The idea of the Dark Ages is very elitist. It's very Eurocentric. It's forgetting about all the amazing cultural stuff happening to the east of Europe. And it's also really based on the idea that the Roman Empire was really the be-all and end-all of culture, which we know it wasn't. So the Dark Ages, let's just not use that term anymore, shall we? One of the other myths that people mention that I really need to talk about is the fact that people still believe that people in the Middle Ages believed that the earth was flat. And this one kind of blows my mind. I have to admit that when I was in high school, when I was in elementary school, you know, I was taught just like everybody else that it was Columbus who showed us that the earth was round. Before that, people thought they would fall off the edge of the earth. And this is what I was taught. And so I believed it. And then I got to university, like I said, and started to learn that people didn't think the earth was flat. And when you start to peel this apart, it is amazing how quickly this unravels. It's strange because this is very, very pervasive. I gave a TED talk a couple years ago, and I started off with the fact that people didn't think the earth was flat back in the day, and I used images to show that people didn't think the earth was flat, which I'll get to in a second. And still, there are people who will argue with me that medieval people thought the earth was flat. So this is a very, very pervasive myth, and it's based on, well, just about nothing. So if I look back at this myth, I see that there was a line from Washington Irving's The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus that mentions that people thought the earth was flat at the time. But before that, there isn't an idea that people in the Middle Ages thought the earth was flat. And if you actually go back to the evidence from the Middle Ages, you'll find all sorts of things that just kind of blow this out of the water. So in the ancient world, the ancient peoples had figured out that the earth was a sphere. And if we look at this, especially ancient Greece, we can see all sorts of evidence for this. The ancient Greeks measured the stars, and they measured them from the horizon. And they did all sorts of complex math, which is way beyond my understanding, to figure out not only that the earth was a sphere, but how big it was. And they were actually really, really close to figuring out the circumference of the earth. And it's only in the 20th century that we've gotten closer than the ancient Greeks to figuring out how big the earth is. And that's based on really, really modern tools. So they had figured out the circumference of the earth. And like I said in the myth section on the Dark Ages, the wisdom of the ancient Greeks didn't disappear. A lot of the classical texts that had been created in the ancient world were mostly studied by Islamic scholars east of Europe. So Islamic scholars were still looking at all of this ancient Greek wisdom, especially things like geometry and astronomy. And those people were much smarter than me when it came to math. And so they were also convinced that the earth was a sphere. And so there was nobody around that really thought it was flat at the time. And if you look at the art from the Middle Ages, you'll see pictures of the earth as a sphere. And in my TED talk, I showed one from Belgium that shows the earth as a sphere. And it's even got the sky, and it's even got an atmosphere. And then the stars beyond, which I think is a pretty amazing image. And if you look at maps that people made of the earth, Mappa Mundi, you'll see the earth as a sphere again. Now, this is a little bit different from how we conceive the earth, especially with our views from space that kind of show us how to make maps. Maps from the Middle Ages were based on theology. So at the center of the earth, which is a sphere, the center of the earth is Jerusalem, because that is the center of the Christian universe. That is where all the most important things happened in Christian theology. So the center of the earth is Jerusalem, and everything moves out from that. So there are certain Mappa Mundi, like I show in my talk when I do this talk, that have Jerusalem in the center and places like Britain at the foot of Jesus. So Jesus looks like the earth. He's round. He's got a head at the top, two hands at the sides, and feet at the bottom. And the geography of the earth is arranged as Christ's body. So you see places like Britain at the bottom. And so because the idea of the earth was based on theology, it also put Jerusalem at the center of the universe. So when we think about medieval astronomy, when we think about medieval technology, we might laugh at them because we think, oh my goodness, how silly is it that they thought that the galaxy revolved around Earth? But again, if we look back a little further, this is the structure of the universe that was theorized by Ptolemy. So this is not necessarily a medieval conception of what the Earth or the movement of the planets looks like. But it is one that they adopted because it worked with theological views. So when we think about astronomy, especially when we think about the Middle Ages, people will say, "Oh my goodness, well, this was ridiculous," and people like Galileo were in trouble for saying that the Earth revolved around the sun. We need to address this in a few ways. And the first one being that Galileo was not a medieval thinker. And so his persecution happened after the Middle Ages. And also that very, very smart people, including the ancient Greeks, thought that the galaxy was Earth-centered. So when we look at this and how people envisioned the Earth, first of all, they thought it was a sphere. Secondly, they knew that the planets moved, and they knew that the stars moved in a way that was predictable. So they really understood how the stars and planets moved. But they went with the Ptolemaic view of the universe because that made sense to them theologically. People in the Middle Ages knew that the Earth is a sphere, and people in the modern world don't believe that the Earth is a sphere. So you tell me who had this one right. And this gets to a point that Eleanor Yaniga asked me to talk about on Twitter, or at least the thing that really grinds her gears, is that there's this idea that the church really quashed science. And this is a total myth, because some of the best people who were scientists in the Middle Ages were theologians. And there's a whole bunch of reasons for this. The most important one probably being that it was the church who educated people. So when people went to school, it was the clergy who taught them how to read and write and show them what to read. Some of the most important inventions were made or thought up by clergy. So people think of the Middle Ages as kind of a dead zone of science. And that's not really true. Some of the best scientists, as I said, were clergymen, including Roger Bacon, who was a monk. Some of his diagrams that show how the eye works are ones that look just like the ones that you will find in modern science textbooks. And that's just one of the things that blows my mind. But if you think about some of the scientific and technological inventions that we owe to the Middle Ages, we're talking about things like buttons, eyeglasses, we're talking about the printing press, clocks, mechanical clocks. You see robots in the Middle Ages. They're wind-up robots. Windmills, watermarks, like you see in paper. The horizontal loom, which was a real game changer, technologically speaking. The spinning wheel. People invented stirrups and spurs and cannons. And so all of these things were invented in the Middle Ages. And they weren't looked upon as being instruments of the devil, for example. They were looked upon as being useful things that people could use to make their lives better. And the church supported innovation. It was important to them. If you look at, for example, cathedrals, it was really important to have good technology for building cathedrals, for example. So you couldn't necessarily have a church that was in opposition to science in general. The church supported scientific knowledge and advancement, and it wasn't opposed to it in the ways that we think about now. Which brings me to another myth that I want to talk about. And that is, people tend to think that in the Middle Ages, everybody believed the same thing. And if you didn't believe that thing, then you were burned as a heretic. First of all, if we talk about everyone believing the same thing, then we are probably talking about Christianity. We're probably talking about a Catholic version of Christianity, which means that we're forgetting about Islam and we're forgetting about Judaism. And these are really, really important religions that we should not be forgetting about, that were definitely present in the Middle Ages and that contributed hugely to culture. So we can't say, for example, that everyone believed the same thing, because we are forgetting not only that people had different versions of Christianity that they believed in, which I'll get to in a second, but also that Christianity was not the only religion at the time. And again, if we're just talking about Europe, we're talking about the big three being Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. But again, there's a whole wide world out there that is beyond Europe, and people were believing in all sorts of other things, which you'll see, like Hinduism and Buddhism. So people were not all believing the same thing. So there's that. And they weren't all believing in the same way. So I think there's this idea that because the church had rules about how to live and what your practices of religion should be, that meant that that was how everybody did things. And they didn't question it, they just went through the motions. And it's kind of funny, because a lot of the sources that we have from the Middle Ages are showing people how to live because they are not following the rules that they're supposed to. So constantly, the Pope is coming up with new canons about how to live because he's seeing that people are not living the way that they were supposed to, the way they were asked to live. There is a huge amount of doubt when you look at original documents from the Middle Ages. It's not all a bunch of robots who are believing the same thing. And you can really see this when you look at the theologians who are writing, because they're trying to work out how theology functions. So when you think about this saying, you know, how many angels could fit on the head of a pin, this is kind of looking at how theologians are trying to work with really tricky questions, like what happens to the soul after death? What happens to the soul of an infant, for example, who dies in the womb? What happens to people who die in sin, but they have been murdered, for example, and they haven't had the chance to confess? So all sorts of tricky theological questions. Kathleen Kennedy was talking about coconut cups and whether you could use them for the Eucharist. And these are the type of questions that people were working out because they had differing opinions on this. And a lot of the really touching documents that I've seen look at people who are doubting. So in some of the stuff I looked at for my book, The 5-Minute Medievalist, one of them is from Eve Salisbury's The Trials and Joys of Marriage. And there is a poem in there that's called How the Good Wife Taught Her Daughter. And in it, it mentions that as a woman in the Middle Ages, you're probably going to lose children. And when that happens, you might doubt in God. You might believe that God does not exist or that he doesn't have a plan for you. And so she says, you know, this is not the time to doubt. Don't despair. You should rely on your faith. Don't lose hope. And the fact that she has to write this means that this is a really common experience for people to go through, where they go through things like grief and they feel like they doubt in the existence of God. And so we can definitely see that people, as I said before, they're not all robots who believed in the same thing when it comes to theology. Not only that, I mean, you see examples of organized religions or religious movements that happened during the Middle Ages. We know about some of them, like the Cathar, what's called the Cathar heresy, because of the way that it was put down. We know that people were accessing their Christianity in ways that weren't sanctioned by the church. So the Cathars, for example, didn't believe that you needed a priest to access the word of God. And they didn't believe that you needed to follow the dietary rules of Christianity, for example, fasting or fish days. They believed that women had more of a role in spirituality than the Catholic Church allowed for. And because it was spread, because a lot of people believed in Catharism, and also because of politics, that is why the Cathar, what they called the Cathar heresy, was put down in a very violent manner. And that crusade against the Cathars was preached to put that down. But again, this shows that people were not believing things in the same way. Another thing I should mention is that Christianity didn't spontaneously just kind of explode and spread across Europe. It was spread by the work of missionaries who were bringing Christianity to people who were believing in other things. And one of the things about Christianity in the Middle Ages was that the people who could access those texts, so the Bible and other theological texts, had to be people who could read in Latin. And that wasn't everybody. So we know that more people were able to read than most people will think. But they weren't supposed to be accessing all of the words of the Bible or interpreting them for themselves. So this meant that people had to rely on a priest to help them accurately figure out what the Bible was saying and how they should practice their Christianity. So the missionaries are coming across Europe and spreading Christianity to people who believed in other things, like I said. So there are going to be mistakes in how they follow their newfound Christianity. People still believed in fairies. They still believed in things that we'd call superstitions now. They still used things like charms to make sure that, for example, someone was safe during a birth. They still followed traditions that weren't necessarily Christian, or they weren't necessarily Christianized. And that didn't mean that those people who, for example, talked about fairies or made sure they went around the church widdershins, didn't mean that those people were immediately burned as heretics. It meant that when a priest came around, and sometimes a priest was not available for a few months at a time, when a priest came around, they would correct that person's faith and make sure that they were following Christian dogma as they should. But it didn't mean that they were punished. They might be given penance, so they would have to say Hail Marys, or they would have to say Our Fathers, and they would have to repent. But it didn't mean that they were persecuted for believing in something that wasn't fully orthodox. If we look at the Arthurian legends, for example, Arthur's a Christian king. He's called like one of the most Christian kings. And yet his sister is what you might call a witch or a fairy. And he gets taken off to Avalon to be healed of his grievous wound. And it seems that he's kind of immortal while this happens. So obviously Christianity and fairies and all sorts of other pagan beliefs, they coexisted at the same time. So people were not getting burned for having beliefs that didn't exactly gel with what the church was asking them to believe. And this is not even to address the different religions that existed in Europe at the time. So we know that European cities were much more multicultural than people have said up to the present day. And that means not only in terms of religion, but also in terms of what we now call race. If we look at this in terms of religion, we see places like what is modern Spain and Portugal, mostly under control of Muslims for a lot of the medieval period. And at that time, there were Christians and there were Jews living in Muslim Spain, and everybody was getting along. And that didn't mean that they were getting along all the time in all the ways. In fact, it was probably pretty unpleasant at times if you were not of the dominant religion. But they did get along. And we also see that people of different religions lived in Christian cities as well. You'll see Jewish quarters, for example, in lots of Christian cities. I really want to be clear on this. It was not the best time to be a religious outlier in history. There was a lot of religious persecution, but it was not to the scale that we tend to think on an everyday basis. So on an everyday basis, you'd see people living together. They would be working together. They may not have had mutual respect for each other, and they may have treated each other badly. But mass violence was more rare than we tend to think. This is not to say that it is not horrific. Some of the worst examples of religious persecution happened during the Black Death, when the Jews were accused of poisoning wells to bring about the pestilence. And they were massacred on a huge scale at that time. And we also know they were expelled from places like England under Edward I and France under Philip IV, and then from Spain as well under Isabella and Ferdinand. So there were times definitely when religious persecution happened. But again, if you were to take a time machine and you were going to drop down into any particular day, you would see what we might call microaggressions or aggressions, but you wouldn't see mass persecution all the time of people who didn't believe what the church asked them to believe. So it's important to remember that the church didn't persecute scientists all the time. That's not what they did. Their mandate was to bring people back into the fold. So if you had a belief that wasn't orthodox, they would do their best to help you repent. And then if you persisted or you spread your heretical belief, then things would get serious. But often it was motivated by other things as well. So one of the most famous heretics, of course, was Joan of Arc. She was burned at the stake, but she was burned at the stake for not just religious reasons, but also political reasons, because this is in the middle of the Hundred Years' War. I would highly recommend Helen Castor's book on Joan of Arc to get into the intricacies of that story. But it will also explain to you, when you look at the trial of Joan of Arc, how the clergy were invested in trying to get her to repent, even if they had an agenda which was always going to turn badly for her. Another thing people asked me to talk about on Twitter was food and water, especially water. One of the things that grinds people's gears about the Middle Ages and what people think about the Middle Ages is that nobody drank water. Again, this is based on kind of a half-truth, which is that water was often dirty in the Middle Ages, which is true. It was often dirty. But that didn't mean that people didn't find clean water to drink. And it didn't mean that they didn't drink water at all. They absolutely drank water. As anybody who has gone to college or university will tell you, you cannot live on alcohol alone without becoming dehydrated. So even though people drank wine and beer quite a lot in the Middle Ages, they also drank water. And they were concerned about the cleanliness of their water. So in urban centers, there were places where you could get clean water. and people were very, very strict about making sure that you did not water your animals in the drinking water, that you did not wash your newly made clothes in the drinking water, that you didn't let the bath water from the public bathhouse, which we'll get to in a second, that you didn't let that run into the drinking water. So they were really trying to make sure that they had clean drinking water because they understood that having dirty water would make you sick. In England, there are ordinances saying that if you are to make a well in your backyard, you have to make sure that it is a certain distance away from your latrine because you don't want to have seepage or you'll get sick. So people were definitely sinking wells in the country, but also in the city, and they were making sure that they were far enough away from the latrines that nobody got sick. I talked a little bit about how some of the best scientists in the world at the time of the Middle Ages were Islamic, and this is definitely true of doctors. One of the most famous doctors of the Middle Ages was Avicenna, or Ibn Sina, and he was definitely an advocate for water. I mean, if you read him, he also says, you know, don't drink wine in the morning. I think that's still good advice today, but don't drink wine in the morning. Take water instead. Water is necessary, definitely, to keep you in good health. And one of my favorite passages from Avicenna talks about making sure that you have clean water. So if you're going on a long trip, make sure you bring enough water. And if you can't bring enough water for the whole trip, make sure that the water that you're getting is clean. And he talks about cleaning it with clay or boiling it, or filtering it through wool, and not just kind of pouring it through wool, but using wool to wick the water up from one container and put it into another one. He says distillation is the best way to get clean water, and that's pretty true today as well. Avicenna says that the best water is running water, and if you can't get that, find water that's nice and clear. And when you get water to drink, make sure that you filter it so that you don't accidentally drink leeches. Which again, I think is really spectacular advice. Beyond water, a lot of people will say that in the Middle Ages, people used spices to cover up rotten food so that people wouldn't notice that the food was rotten, because I guess there was a lot of rotten food in the Middle Ages. This is another myth that doesn't make a lot of sense, because if you look back to sources from the Middle Ages, you'll see that spices were hugely expensive. And many of them came from far away, so they were hard to get as well. So why on earth you would put expensive spices on rotten food is beyond me. Rotten food is going to make you sick, and they knew that. So I don't know why you would put spice on it to disguise the taste of it, but hey, maybe modern myth makers know more than I do. Spices were coming from all sorts of places. So some of the most famous ones, expensive ones, were things like cinnamon and cumin and pepper. And if you look at the wonders of the East, or the marvels of the East, there's a really great story about how you get pepper and why it's so expensive. And that is because it's guarded by giant snakes. So you wouldn't waste the pepper that you fought a giant snake to get to put on food that's going to be rotten, because it's just not worth the food poisoning, even if it tastes fantastic. So a lot of people, what people believe about medieval food is, again, based on myth. People did drink water for sure. They didn't use spices to disguise the taste of rotten food. Sorry, that is just not true. And finally, something that everyone asked me to talk about, that I would have talked about anyway, because it is a serious myth about the Middle Ages, is that everybody was dirty and they liked it that way. Of course, you can see the best example of this is in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, where the peasants are collecting filth. Which is one of my favorite scenes, actually. They're collecting filth. It's great filth. And, you know, you can never have enough filth. The truth is, of course, different. And part of it is that we have to cut people in the Middle Ages some slack. And part of it is, again, we've just got our information wrong. So we know that the Romans loved baths. And the Romans are really well known for their loving to bathe. And so when they moved across Europe, when they conquered all sorts of places in Europe, they built bathhouses because they loved to bathe. And when the Roman Empire receded, those bathhouses didn't disappear. People still used the bathhouses because a lot of them were made ingeniously using hot springs, and they were really, really useful. People loved them. So they kept bathing in these Roman baths. And they built other baths too, because They loved to bathe. So a typical medieval bathhouse might look like a Roman bathhouse, and then it might be reusing Roman technology. So kind of like a swimming pool where a whole bunch of people would sit. Or it might be a room that had all sorts of kind of half barrels that were full of hot water. They would be draped with linen sheets to make sure that you didn't get a splinter in your bum. And they might be tented with linen sheets as well to keep the steam in, keep everything nice. And all sorts of people used the bathhouses, men and women, people of different religions. Many times they had their own bathhouses, and many times they shared bathhouses when at different times. And if you look at pictures from the Middle Ages, you'll see lots of people enjoying the bathhouse. And one of the things that you'll see is that they were often eating at the bathhouse, which is something that we don't tend to think of as being kind of something that you do at a swimming pool or in the bath, have your dinner with it. But again, bathing was still connected to this idea of feeling great, kind of luxurious. And you could have your dinner at the bathhouse, and people tended to do that. So you'll see that in medieval images of the bathhouse. And I need to say that the idea of people not bathing is another strange one, because there are so many images from the Middle Ages of people in the bathtub. So that's just another one that kind of blows my mind. So not only were people having baths and having a lot of baths, but they were also using soap. Again, we look at the Romans as being kind of the height of sophistication, but Romans didn't use soap as much as medieval Europeans did. Romans tended to use a strigil, which if you watch Spartacus, you'll see all the gladiators using, which is kind of a scraping stick. So you'd oil your body and then you'd scrape off the dirt. But people in the Middle Ages used soap. And you could use a kind of a rough and ready type soap that you'd make from wood ash, which you'd mix with tallow or fat. And that was really effective. And if you watch Secrets of the Castle, you'll see Ruth is washing dishes with this kind of soap made from wood ash and tallow. But this makes an alkaline type soap. So it's actually really not very comfortable to use on your body. So instead, you could use an olive oil soap, something much nicer. So we see people talking about olive oil soap or white soap in places like the Trotula, which is a compendium of women's medicine that also talks about cosmetics. So they recommend using this gentle soap, especially on your face. If you look in the Decameron by Boccaccio, you'll see that people use a clove-scented soap. So we know that people put herbs in the bath to make sure that they smelled nice, but it looks like they also put herbs in their soap to make sure that that smelled nice. So we know people are bathing. We know they're using soap. We know for sure that they definitely needed to wash their hands before they had dinner, for example. And monks often had to wash their hands before Mass. So they would have sinks installed in some places so that you could wash your hands before you ate, or you could wash them before Mass. And if you didn't have a sink close by, you could have a water jug for your guests to wash their hands before they ate. And it was well-mannered to make sure that you washed your hands before you ate. So again, this is another thing you see all over the place, and I'm not sure why it became a myth, but it did. People definitely washed their hands a lot. I mentioned that we should cut medieval people a bit of slack, and that is because if you're going to have a bath, you need to heat all that water and you need to carry all that water. So if you're having a private bath at your house, that means heating up a whole lot of water and hauling it to where your bathtub is. Now, if you're a king like King John, who apparently had his bath come around with him on when he went on tours of his realm, then you could have people do that for you. But if you had a private bath at your house, that meant heating a lot of water and carrying it and then getting rid of it later, which means getting all sweaty again. So we have to cut people some slack. Edward I decided he was going to cut out the middleman and install taps, although he probably did have middlemen at the other end that were warming up the bath for him so that he could have this water coming out of the tap for him. We know that people tried to bathe without bathtubs or without bathhouses, because we do have coroner's reports that show that people drowned trying to get clean. Sometimes they were washing in ditches, sometimes they were washing in rivers or lakes, but we know that they were trying to get clean and they ended up drowning. So we know that people were invested in getting clean. It was later on in the early modern period that people started to get worried about things like plague and syphilis, and they stopped going to the bathhouses because of it. We know that people were worried about congregating too closely and passing on germs, which is one of the reasons that they shut down the playhouses, for example, in some of Shakespeare's day. They did shut down the bathhouses sometimes in the Middle Ages, but that's mostly because people were getting naked together and they were sometimes having liaisons when they were naked together, sometimes with prostitutes and sometimes just with other people that they shouldn't have been with. So while they did close the bathhouses sometimes in the Middle Ages, it wasn't because they worried about people getting sick from being clean. And finally, after you're clean, you tend to want to get into clean clothes. And people did wash their clothes, believe it or not. They washed their clothes, they washed their sheets, they washed towels and napkins, and they used all of these things. So when we think about people being filthy in the Middle Ages, we're forgetting about things like laundry and the many, many laundresses who were working, making sure that people had clean sheets and clothes. Now, often these laundresses were very badly paid, and they were often women on their own, so they were thought of as being next to prostitutes, so not very well regarded, but their job was really important. We know that hospitals, for example, the hospitals in Paris had people that were washing the sheets, and we know they were washing the sheets in the Seine, and sometimes they were even drifting off into the Seine, and they had to have a boatman that would go out and fetch them if they started to drift away too far. It's Carol Rawcliffe that's done a lot of work on laundry. So if you're interested in that and a lot of work on how it was to live in the urban centers in Europe, you should check out Carol Rawcliffe's stuff. So kind of in conclusion, people in the Middle Ages were actually very, very clean. It was the people who were living in the early modern period who decided that you would be clean enough if you just wiped with linen. And I think that the collection of advice from a book called Ask the Past, whose author I've just forgotten, but Ask the Past is the name of the book, has collected all sorts of interesting tidbits, including one that says you should just wipe with linen, even for the goat-like stench of armpits. So I would much rather live in the Middle Ages when it comes to hygiene than I would in the early modern period. And that's not even getting into things like toothpaste or shampoo or all sorts of things which you can find in the Trotula and elsewhere. There are so many more myths about the Middle Ages that I could address and maybe will address on other podcasts, but these are just some of the ones that grind my gears and that bother other historians and history buffs that I've talked to on Twitter and Facebook. And again, if these are things that you didn't know, that's no problem because we're all taught all sorts of weird things about the Middle Ages. And I'm hoping that by talking about it and getting out there and having people discuss it, then we'll start to dispel some of these myths and we'll have kind of a better platform from which people can start learning about the Middle Ages. I should probably mention that many of the things I talked about today are in the book I've just written for Pen and Sword Press, which will be coming out in September in the UK, December in Canada, and January in the United States. It's called Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fictions, and my hope is that it answers all sorts of your burning questions about the Middle Ages. Before we go, here's Peter from Medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's up, Peter?
Hey, Danielle. Yep. I think I'm the highlight of this week's podcast. So, yeah, I've got a lot to talk about. So,
all right.
First of all, you can now get your own Lewis Chessman.
It's, really?
Yeah. It's the 94th piece has just arrived. And after being hidden in like a someone's drawer for like 50 years, they found it, and it's going up for auction. And it's, so it's this kind of piece that had long lost is now going up for auction in London in July. They're expecting about £1 million for it. But I actually think it's going to do a lot better than that. It's one of those iconic pieces from the Middle Ages. All the others are kept in museums in the United Kingdom. So with this one, I think there's going to be a real bidding war among various museums to who is going to have this last kind of piece of the Lewis Chessman set. So we have a piece on that. That was big news last week. We also have Shari Boots. She's written another piece in her Augustine in the Middle Ages series. And she's actually wrapping that series up. She's only says she's got only about three more posts to go. So I don't know if it comes to a dramatic conclusion with Augustine coming back from the dead, but we'll see. And but yeah, I've been loving her kind of work. It's kind of talked about how his influence throughout the Middle Ages, his writings, in this case is like fake writings by Augustine. So look for that piece about did Augustine believe in monsters? on a site. And finally, there is a piece on if you want to become an evil wizard, we have a piece on that. So some medieval magic spells to share with you. But don't use them unless you like really hate someone. So
there's a warning in place on this article.
I should have put one, I guess. I feel real bad about that now. But anyways, that you can read on the site. And actually, it was like a ton of stuff on this week on the site. So feel free to explore medievalist.net.
All right. We will. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
If you love the podcast and want to help out, consider becoming one of our patrons on Patreon. You can help keep us going and even grab yourself a subscription to Medieval Warfare Magazine. Check it out at patreon.com/medievalists. For all sorts of great news and information, you can always follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. And if you want to keep up with me, Danielle Cebulski, or tell me more of your favorite myths, you can find me on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. You can also find my books, including pre-ordering the one I just talked about, on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for sharing this moment in history with me. Have yourself an awesome day.